Okay, great. So I'm Rick Hansen. This is January 31st, 2018. And as you may know, if you've been here before recently, I'm going to go this year through a Buddhist take on these 12 fundamental underlying factors of well-being and equanimity. Resilience is a secular way for me of describing the Buddhist take on equanimity, which is finding that internal place of balance in which we meet the next moment, feeling already full, already strong, already free, even as we deal with the real challenges out in the world and even arising inside our own mind. So I'm working my way through the year and hitting some of the key topics that relate to that. And this week, I'd like to talk about acceptance, especially self-acceptance, which for me is under the general heading of the strength of compassion. That's the first strength in the sequence I go through, which also tracks the sequence in the Foundations of Well-Being program, if you're involved in that program. So self-acceptance, right? For many of us, including me, not always the easiest thing in the world. So do you all have a copy of this handout? When I found this passage from Thich Nhat Hanh, it really kind of pierced me. I felt very touched by it. And by the way, we have more over there, and you know, feel free to get more or just read with a neighbor. And I'd like to just read it, talk a little bit about it. As is my intention this year, I want to kind of build in a little bit of directed experiential practice in this portion of the evening, and then let's talk about it, okay? So Thich Nhat Hanh says, your purpose is to be yourself. You don't have to run anywhere to become someone else. You are wonderful just as you are. This teaching of the Buddha allows us to enjoy ourselves, the blue sky, and everything that is refreshing and healing in the present moment. There is no need to put anything in front of us and run after it. We already have everything we are looking for, everything we want to become. The Heart Sutra says that there is nothing to attain. We meditate not to attain enlightenment because enlightenment is already in us. We don't have to search anywhere. We don't need a purpose or a goal. We don't practice in order to obtain some high position. In aimlessness, we see that we do not lack anything, that we already are what we want to become, and our striving just comes to a halt. We are at peace in the present moment, just seeing the sunlight streaming through our window or hearing the sound of the rain. People talk about entering nirvana, but we are already there. For me, the marker of beings who are really far along, including all the way, is that you read a few sentences or paragraphs or words, and for me at least, I feel like my mind starts evaporating like dry ice turning to gas. And so I want to just comment a little bit here and, in a sense, approach this passage in a way at three levels. So one way of understanding it, in my view, is that Thich Nhat Hanh is speaking to a notion that's implicit in early Buddhism and very explicit in Tibetan, Zen, and Buddhism, this notion of underlying Buddha nature, underlying natural wholesomeness, the underlying ground of our own psychology as fundamentally good and awake, loving and pure. I think of a little bit of the metaphor of having a house that's been boarded up for 30 years. And you move into the house, kind of a metaphor for the being, the person. And there's a faucet there that hasn't been used for 30 years. And you turn on the faucet, and the water that comes out is full of green, smelly, nasty, dirty sludge. And the instinct understandably, is to turn off the faucet.
Hey.
But what we actually have to do is to let it flow. And the deep understanding is to recognize that the water itself is always inherently pure, stainless, innocent. It may hold or represent crud, sludge that needs to be purified in some way, but the water, the ground of being, the space of consciousness, the who we deeply are, is itself just fine. It's a very fundamental way of orienting to this. As people drop into that, in ways that are very meaningful for many people, there's a sense that the deepest roots of our existence edge into something that's meaningfully distinct from, in some sense, outside the ordinary frame of the physical world, of ordinary reality. We're edging into something the Buddha called unconditioned, the deathless, that which is not subject to deterministic arising and passing away, and therefore is an ultimately reliable basis for lasting happiness, because that which is transcendental is eternal, is timeless. We live in time, and yet, arguably, the banks of the river of time are timelessness. Now, if you don't relate to that stuff, it's really okay. The Buddha gives us plenty of options without relating to it, but I want to call out that for many people, the deepest ground of being, and in ways that are experienced by them and important to them, and this is the case for me as well, those deeper roots into the transcendental, that which is meaningfully distinct from ordinary reality, shine up through us, in effect, as we engage ordinary existence. Okay. So this, to me, is the first way to understand what he's saying. He's talking about true nature, deep nature, that which arguably is uncovered by practice. That's one way to relate to that. A second way to relate to this is that as we do reasonable things to grow, to release, to heal, to cultivate wholesome qualities, to become more compassionate, to become more mindful, that as we do that, and we could also say as we remove the obscurations, as they say in Tibet, from pure, radiant, perfectly fine already, deep nature, true nature, that as we do our practices of releasing what's problematic and engaging in wise effort, one of the elements of the Eightfold Path, and cultivating the wholesome, the beneficial, for other people's sake as well as our own, that as we do that process of, in effect, deliberate change, deliberate growth, we do it on the basis of an ongoing sense of the truth of what Thich Nhat Hanh is saying. Do you see? In other words, you could take what he's saying as an argument for complacency, for just, yeah, be a neurotic jerk, no big, you're perfect as you are, right? So how do we hold those two elements? How do we hold the profundity of this kind of acceptance and appreciation and peacefulness about who we are? How do we hold that and the benefits of that, which cut through a lot of neurotic self-improvement? How do we hold that while also doing wise effort and cultivating wise view, wise intention, wise speech, wise livelihood? How do we hold this as we work for social justice, as we try to help other people, as we try to help the world become a better place, right? That's the question. And I think one way to relate to it is to engage in practices of growth and healing and learning, development, very reasonable things, while trying to keep returning again and again to an underlying sense of what he's talking about here. It's a work in progress for me, but being able to have a feeling for and hold together the truth of what he's saying about being yourself and enjoying yourself as you are While at the same time, let's say in my own case, trying to help myself be more patient about the emails I've got to deal with, or some minor aggravation with my wife, my great teacher, or something else. How do you hold those both together? Okay. And then finishing up here, the third kind of way of, to me, relating to this is to explore deliberate practices of self-acceptance. Because most people, including myself, have a hard time accepting themselves, actually, completely as they are. Completely. So I want to offer a few suggestions about practices of self-acceptance and do one with you and then kind of open it up here. All right? So with regard to self-acceptance, one aspect of that is to distinguish between self-criticism and self-guidance. It's a little bit like, to simplify the psyche, on our shoulders are two forces, two beings, two committees. One that is critical in a problematic way, that tears us down, that's punishing, often the internalization of others who are dismissive or punishing or rejecting, shaming or scolding. What we learn what they did to us and then we do it to ourselves. The inner critic, let's call that. And then there's also the inner guide or the inner nurturer, the part of ourselves that puts things in perspective, helps us get back up again, reminds us, okay, sweetie, you screwed up. Register what you did. Feel the wince of healthy remorse in proportion to what happened. Okay. Breathe, pause, and you're a beautiful being, and let's get back to work. Kind of like that. That part of ourself. That's a guide. Right? So there's an important distinction between the inner critic that tears us down. You can have a feeling for it. You can watch what your face does when you kind of move into it. And then you can have a sense of the inner guide, the inner nurturer. Right? We don't become complacent and horrible when we drop the inner critic. We draw upon increasingly the inner guide. So how do you grow the inner guide, the inner nurturer, so that it is more able to kind of crowd out the inner critic and balance it and speak up for you to it? So that's one piece here. So tracking the distinction mindfully. What's the inner critic feel like? What's the inner guide feel like? Feeling the difference between the two. And when you're experiencing the inner guide or you're with other people who are themselves nurturing, encouraging, supportive, they call out what could be done better next time, but they don't do it in a way that beats you up. They do it in a way that lifts you up to a higher road. And when you have an experience of that, whether it's coming from the inside or from the outside, marinate in that experience of the inner guide, which will help to hardwire that fundamental way of being more and more inside yourself so it becomes your natural home base. Okay. First suggestion. Second suggestion has to do with how we regard the whole of the psyche. And one way to think of it is the metaphor, again, of a very large house. And I think what happens is that when babies are born, they can occupy all the rooms. They can be sad, they can be angry, they can fuss, they can feud, they can smile. They live the whole rooms. And then life happens. And so they're in one of their rooms, maybe they're really excited. Now they're 5 years old, they're getting on people's nerves. The shutdown message comes, whoa, never go into that room again. Close that room up. Maybe another room is they're angry about something, usually rightfully, but whoa. In my family, by the way, growing up, parents had a monopoly on anger. Or expressed anger, I'll say. Look, that room, shut it down. And then there are many other rooms that eventually get shut down. And sometimes what's in those rooms is a little weird, or a little creepy, or a little spooky. All right. But it doesn't mean that we need to slam the door on it. Okay. So now here we are in adulthood, and instead of being able to live freely in all the rooms of our home and move in and out of them and have control over whether the door is open or closed without it being boarded up and bricked up. We instead, unfortunately, many of us, we live in a tiny little place of the mansion of the totality of our psyche, of who we really are. So part of the process then is to be aware of what's been disowned or repressed or pushed aside, pushed off to exile. What aspects of yourself have you sent to Siberia or your favorite place of exile? And in addition to that kind of mindfulness, a kind of self-awareness, a growing willingness to kind of reclaim all the rooms in the mansion of your being, of your psyche, and to feel more and more okay, like, all right, that's a part of myself. It needs to be regulated, perhaps. Or when it comes out to play, I need to also remember, don't break anything. But I can be all right with, and I can accept and include every single room in the mansion of my psyche. That's a second thing. And then finishing up, third practical suggestion around self-acceptance is to be very deliberately self-accepting. For example, to think about aspects of yourself that might be really challenging to accept as they are. We can still prefer that something be different while accepting the fact of it, its existence. So for example, being willing to accept your body and every part of your body for what it is. Can do that. Can you tell yourself very deliberately, I accept the part of me that is needy? It's kind of a taboo for many people. Can I accept the part of me that is angry? Can I accept the part of me that is like Peter Pan crowing, I'm so wonderful, look at me. Can you accept that part of yourself? Can you accept the part of yourself that gets irritable? Can you accept your sexuality? Can you accept your intensity? Can you accept your longing for love? Can you? And it's very helpful to say deliberately to yourself, quite deliberately, I accept this. Right? Thighs, I accept you. Anger, I accept you. The thought that I'm special, a special snowflake, I accept you, right? Just think about all the things that are kind of hard to accept about yourself, or you'd be embarrassed if other people knew that thing about you. Can you accept it? And then feel the acceptance and allow the acceptance to sink in. That's a third very practical thing. So I thought I could do a little experiential thing with you right here, and then we could talk about all this, okay? All right. So I'll do it in this order. So first off, and this is a little practice, it's not the only way to do it, it's sort of like a micro practice, all right? So pick something about yourself that you like about yourself. So that's an easy one. So whatever that might be, identify it, like, you know, that you're playful or you have a warm heart or you're a good baker. You try hard, whatever that might be. And so deliberately name it to yourself and say to yourself in your mind, I accept such and such, and see how that feels. And find your own language. You might use language like, you know, I accept that it's true that I fill in the blank. Or you might call out a part of you you like and name it, like, feisty, rambunctious kid in me, I really accept you. Whatever's real for you. Just, you can do more. That's a great question. Keep going. It's kind of nice, okay? To see what that's like, okay? And then, if you can, pick something that's more challenging, but within reach. And it's really okay for there to be a wish that it was different, while at the same time surrendering to the fact of it in you. And again, find your own language. You might say something like, I accept the reality that I get irritated sometimes. Or, getting tearful. You're a part of me, and I accept that. Whatever works for you. Okay. And notice, see if you can get a feeling for, what this is like to accept parts of yourself that maybe you tend to push away. And to include them. That's another nice word here. Include them in the whole of who you are. And then, if I could, a second little mini micro practice here is to get a feeling for the experience of what Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching here. And I'll read this one more time. And see if you can use his words, which really can come from his own mind stream. There's a transmission here of his state of being. See if you can use his words to help you settle into some of this way of being itself. Your purpose is to be yourself. You don't have to run anywhere to become someone else. You are wonderful just as you are. This teaching of the Buddha allows us to enjoy ourselves, the blue sky, and everything that is refreshing and healing in the present moment. There is no need to put anything in front of us and run after it. We already have everything we are looking for, everything we want to become. We are at peace in the present moment. Just seeing the sunlight streaming through our window or hearing the sound of the rain. We see that we do not lack anything, that we already are what we want to become, and our striving just comes to a halt. Okay. So I left out a couple of the sentences, but you have the handout. And in the interest of time, maybe we can open it up now and have some discussion about this. So, what do you make of all this? Acceptance, your fundamental wonderfulness already, and balancing that sense of the all-rightness of who you are already with helping yourself heal and grow. And then also last, some aspects or practices of deliberate self-acceptance. So any comments or questions so far? Great, Lily.
I had a real hard time accepting the thing I didn't like about it.
Yeah.
And so my question is, there are probably things about each of us that maybe aren't good, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Accepting, if you're a mass murderer or something, then yeah. Obviously that's obvious. So how do you balance that? In other words, there's something in yourself that doesn't meet your standard of what's good, and you want to change it. But how can you? What do you do with that? I mean, there's some place for criticism.
Right.
How do you?
Yeah, it's a very deep question, right? How do we? For me, there are kind of two sides of the same coin in a sense. How do we experience our already innate goodness? Presuming that's true, and I think it is true, how do we rest in that while still engaging in wise effort of various kinds? How do we do that? Flip the other way. How do we help ourselves grow and learn and become more skillful, including with other people, without getting sucked into stressful striving? Right? Very huge, deep question. Lots of people have really engaged this question, and it's a fundamental question. And I have kind of just two suggestions about it. The first is that the more that we have a sense of our own goodness, including whether it's at the deepest level that to me Thich Nhat Hanh is speaking to or pointing to, or in a more ordinary sense of feeling our good heart or knowing that we have good character, that we have good virtue, or that we're the kind of person who will blow it but then clean up the mess later. To me, I'm not myself yet able to stop blowing it, but I'm pretty accountable, or I try to be at least, that I am willing to cop to my BS and clean up the mess as best I can. And so if you know that about yourself, or if you know that you're someone who wants to try and help, when you know that about yourself, it's a lot easier to face your blemishes, what in Buddhism are sometimes called the defilements, that's a pretty intense word, hindrances, the poisons, the stuff, right? To use the metaphor, if you know you are water, it's a lot easier to face and name and deal with the dog dew floating down the river. Hope I didn't gross anybody out too far there. So, you know what I mean? So that's the first thing, right? And then the second thing is that, to me, it's just very straightforward to see reality. Like, reality includes fill in the blank, whatever it is. Can we accept the existence of that piece of reality? Can we surrender to its factuality, in a sense, while simultaneously being aware of reasonably wholesome values? Like, yeah, it's an extreme example, but can we simultaneously just accept the reality of fill in the blank, horrible things that happen, while at the same time doing what we can to improve them? And I think both are true. And then the last is a little trick. If you have a hard time accepting something about yourself, can you accept that you cannot accept it? See, you do that, and you go, so what'll happen is, all right, so I'll just do this for myself live. So yeah, I can be kind of pushy, actually, that I want things to go well. And there's a part of me that can get impatient or exasperated that when other people to me who could work a little harder to have something go well, like, come on, like what, right? And so, okay. So that arises. Can I accept that part of me? No, let's say. And then, well, can I accept that I can't accept it? And then, I don't know. I think I ought to be able to accept it. Okay. Can I accept that I cannot accept that I can't accept that? And you start moving out. It's a hall of mirrors, but it's a trick, but it really works. You get to a place where, yeah, and then you dry, and it feels. You feel it. You feel it. That you're in this place of acceptance again. Okay? All right. Great. Okay, good. All right, please.
Now, what about if you accept something about yourself that I'm just the way that I am this way, but it's not, right? But you want to change it.
Yeah.
And you know that it's not a good thing, but you still are. Say, I worry a lot, it's hard for me to accept that, but it causes me stress, anxiety, it's problematic. So.
Well, that's great. No, so I think if we're angry at ourselves for being a certain way, or we're ashamed of ourselves. And there's kind of a definition of shame as, you know, that which we wish were hidden is exposed, right? So maybe there are parts of ourselves that we just, we're uncomfortable about them being exposed to other people, okay? If that's our stance toward ourselves, that actually gets in the way of release of what's problematic and replacing it with something that's, in some sense, better, more wholesome, more beneficial, more enjoyable. So that kind of attitude of anger at yourself and the critic, meanness, gets in the way, actually, of growth. So keeping that in mind. So then, once we have the stance of acceptance, which is really aided by a sense that our underlying nature is good. So instead of having to scratch and claw our way up the mountain to become an enlightened person, actually Ajahn Sumedho, one of the main monks in the kind of lineage of that I stand in, said it's very interesting to try to play a little game in your mind, if you will. Instead of being someone who seeks to become enlightened, imagine that you're actually already enlightened and you're entering the next moment, including dealing with your own neurotic mind. Right? So it's interesting to flip it around, to go the other way. And then you go to work on it. I mean, for me, and I have a kind of framework about that, I've written a lot about that, but for me there are really three aspects of working with the mind usefully or productively, or engaging the mind productively. The first is to be able to simply be with what's there. Can you step back from worry and witness it? Can you observe it mindfully? And after a while, can you start to recognize its nature as an experience? Worry, hearing, loving, rage, all have the same nature as experiences. That was one of the Buddha's great contributions. He dropped below the level of content to the level of what's the nature of all experience. Right? And you recognize that it's transient, it's changing, it's dynamic, there's no owner, there's no director, there's no screenwriter. It's just happening, arising dependently on a zillion causes. So that too is very freeing, just that kind of being with your experience. The second major way to, for me, practice with experience is to release what's problematic, to focus on letting go. Can we let go of anxious worry? Can we let go of the body sensations of tension related to anxiety? Can we disengage from thoughts that make us worry? Can we pull out of loops of rumination and preoccupation? Can we that's it. And then the third great way to practice for me is to replace what we've released with something better, something useful, wiser, more effective, more enjoyable. So can we replace worry with feeling more and more secure? Can we replace it with feeling calmer in the body? Can we replace it with the felt sense of being cared about by others? Right, so that's, to me, the practice. And as a guy who makes his living helping people change for the better, hopefully better, I think it's really important to be careful about the very Western striving, self-improvement, endless process that people can get very caught up in, which often has a lot to do with impressing other people, right? And you just, again, you can feel what he's talking about there, where you just go, oh man, I so want to swear, but I don't swear from this teaching position, where you just go, the heck with it. But you might be more forceful in your own mind as I am. Where you just go, I'll tell you a little story. I don't know, how many of you ever did the S training? Okay, some of you ever did it. Okay, so here, one of the very first things they do in this personal growth intense workshop, you know, from Werner Erhard, et cetera, back in the 70s. So one of the main things, and I'm going to be a little PG-13 in my language here, they basically, the guy who's leading it, or the person, often a woman who's leading it, looks at everybody in the room and says, "You are all assholes." Whoa, I paid $300 in 1975 for this? You know, and then you go from there. But the point of it is that we're all assholes, in a sense. We're all goofballs. We all have warts. We all have faults. We're all imperfect. Trying to perfect the ordinary mind is like polishing Jell-O. You just can't do it. So my wife and I, who had both done the S training, were sitting around the dinner table with our kids. And we were fairly careful with our language around them. And I remember this, they were probably about 9 and 6, roughly. And we started telling the story about the S training and how we realized that we were assholes. And then we started blowing their mind. I said, yeah, like, Jen, you're an asshole. And then, you know, like, the kids are like, what? And then she goes, yeah, Rick, you're an asshole too. And I went, yeah, Forrest, you know, you're an asshole, but it's okay. And they're like, their eyes are bugging out, you know, and they're like working it, like, I'm gonna tell my dad he's an asshole. I've always wanted to do that. But there's something freeing, you know, where we just go, what the heck, right? And anyway, when we're in that place, it's a lot easier, as appropriate ways, to kind of gently nudge ourselves into a better place. But on the basis of this underlying sense of relaxing and lowering down, just and dropping the very Western project of endless management of how the audience out there and the audience inside our own mind is reacting to us moment after moment after moment. What a relief. Wouldn't that feel like, what a relief? To heck with it. Okay, maybe not. I saw hands moving over here. Great.
I found that I could have a lot of compassion if I started with, I accept the fact that I can be irresponsible or an aversion to detail. When I went to the second part of, and I accept the underlying anxiety, I could have a lot of compassion for, I know where some of the anxiety comes from, and then it was very easy to accept. But I had to get to the second underlying piece of it.
Yeah. That's good. I think that's very apt, that very often, and this relates to the first way of practicing I was describing, being with what's there. Often we have to get down to the bottom and to feel it. We have to, in a sense, experience it fully to really go, yeah, deep down, like almost everyone, I'm afraid of dying. I want everybody to think I'm wonderful. I'm a human being. I'm a big naked ape, right? And that's, you get down to the, how whatever is the bottom, deep down. And then that's a lot easier. Okay, yeah, thanks for saying that. That was great. Okay, maybe one more, I'm gonna finish with you and I'm gonna be quick. Okay. I wanna wrap up at 8:30 normally. Yeah, please.
I'm wondering, we all live in a survivalist world where everything, all the elements are encroaching upon us. Basically, how do we, it's one thing to embrace our weaknesses and be humble and just yet also on the dichotomous side, keep striving.
Right.
Yet it seems that the unhealthy side of our ego will just stop at no ends to destroy us, because we will, it will eat away at us until we deteriorate and our demise is imminent because our cravings are so powerful. But what about the healthy side of the ego? Can't that catapult the striving to where it needs to be? Can it flip the switch that needs to be flipped so that we can be in the present moment?
That's very cool. All right. And so much in that, I'm not sure I grasped every part of it. I think to me, how I would relate to what you're saying is to recognize in us innately, and in my view, it's actually innate in our ordinary psychology, and it's, because I'm a transcendentalist at heart, it's innate definitely in the underlying unconditioned ground of being, that there is something very powerful in us that calls us home. It calls us home. It calls us home to wisdom, to peacefulness, to non-contentiousness with other people, to not quarreling. It calls us home, right?
It does not require a precondition, though.
Well, I think it's innate, actually. And I'll finish on this point if I could. I remember this gesture of my father. I've told you in here about it. He's no longer alive. Grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, had that kind of culture. And He had this gesture. He would just kind of move his hand. I should stand on a chair so you can see it, but imagine this. He would just kind of move his hand like that, sort of like this, right? He grew up around animals, ranching, that kind of environment. And he would say essentially, don't fuss with that, Rick. And he wasn't shaming. It wasn't the voice of the critic. It was the voice of the guide. You don't need to fuss with that. You can lay that down. Oh, sweetie, I see you carrying that stone. You can drop it. You don't need to carry that around. You don't need to engage that. You don't need to entangle your mind with that. The Buddha often used the language of disentangling. No need to fuss with that. You might even imagine it, speaking of embodiment, in your own body, what that gesture might be for you. Or just kind of a shrug, or I don't need to mess with that. Let it go. And I think we can apply a lot of that to our own preoccupations with self-improvement. It's okay. Let it go. It's okay to be messed up. Okay? And meanwhile, love. So on that, how about we sit quietly for a minute, finish up. Be yourselves. See you next week. Take good care.